There's the big board, the 20 electoral votes from the state of Pennsylvania. We just got new metrics in.
The inauguration of a president celebrates a peaceful transition of power engineered by the American voters.
This is your life now. This is our election now. This is us. This is our country. It's real.
Hi, and welcome to the 45th this week, our lovely listeners. This is Rabia Chaudhry. I'm here with my co-host, as always, Susan Simpson. Hey, Susan, how are you?
Hey, Rabia. I'm good. And this week we have a special guest, actually.
We have an awesome new guest. I'm so excited to have him on. And let me tell our listeners all about him before he joins us. Dr. Haroon Ola is joining us this week. He is a chief strategy officer for the Broadcasting Board of Governors, which is an $800 million global media agency. And before that, and up until very recently, Haroon was a senior advisor at the Department of State. In fact, he has served as a senior advisor to three secretaries of state. His expertise is digital transmedia strategy and CVE, countering violent extremism, which is a space I worked in for a bit. He is also the recipient of a Peabody TV Award. He is currently an adjunct professor at Georgetown University. He's a term member of the Council on Foreign Relations. And as if that wasn't enough, he's also an award-winning author of two books, which I urge our listeners to check out. They are great books. One is Digital World War from Yale University Press, and the other one is called Countering Hate, which was written with Bob Pearson, in which he takes a look at the information battlefield, which is so important right now, and how we can turn the tide. And one of the most important things also to add is that Haroon is a dear friend of mine. So I'm so excited to have you on, Haroon. Welcome to the show.
I'm so thrilled to be on. I'm such a huge fan. So I'm just excited to be here.
I'll be honest. I have been wanting to have Haroon on for a long time, but he was at State. He's like, no, Rabia, stop it. I can't.
So first off, can you break down for me a bit what transmedia, I've forgotten the rest of it already, sorry.
Strategy.
There we go.
That's a good question. In fact, I learned a lot about it at South by Southwest this past week because of all the new breakthroughs. But essentially, transmedia is, it looks at just different mixed platform content. So, you know, things that sort of go between, you know, digital that make their way to radio and cross platforms. And it deals a lot with this new trend in audience architecture. So a lot of young people with transmedia, they're not just getting, you know, it's like how you transform radio into podcasts. But, you know, the idea is that over the top TV, OTT, smart TVs are actually the main way in a lot of places like the Middle East and South Asia, which people are accessing content. So it's not just your mobile phones. It's called OTT. So that's a little what I do.
Was that also the main focus of your work at the State Department?
State was a little different. I mean, State was, I worked a lot under public diplomacy. So the sort of range of programs, everything from exchange programs to citizen diplomacy, Rabia, which I know you've been on, to sort of funding NGOs and working with civil society organizations and young leaders. You know, I had met Malala many years ago before she became well-known and through some of our young leadership programs. So, you know, it was a range of things, and I worked under that kind of rubric, which is mostly stuff in the field, which is where my heart is.
I think I'd have two questions for you to start with. First is, why did you join State? And second is, why did you leave?
Good question. I would say that I joined, you know, I was coming out of grad school, and my former advisors that had been on my dissertation committee, his name was Vali Nasser. And so he was, you know, he had come and joined, he'd worked for Richard Holbrooke. And they were looking for specialists on South Asia. And I had just finished a lot of my field work in South Asia. And, you know, I never thought about actually joining State Department. I wanted to be involved in foreign policy. And so I sort of backed into it because they needed some people that had expertise in Pakistan and Afghanistan. Although I have to say, well, I grew up in small town America, and Robbie knows this. I grew up very rural in a lot of ways. And I grew up in a town, a small town in Eastern Washington State. And so when I was growing up, people would always ask me, Haroon, what's going on in Iraq or what's going on in Pakistan? And I had no idea. They just, you know, I guess I looked like someone that might know, i.e. it was brown. And so they were like, explain it to us. And I was like, I have no idea. And so I have to say sort of a seed was planted that I was curious about what's going on. And so, you know, State Department, it was such a great experience, and I got to serve a lot of it abroad. And the second part of your question is, you know, I think that How long
were you there, first of all? How long were you at State?
Almost 10 years. Yeah.
10 years.
Almost 10 years, yeah. So I think that when I thought about leaving, it was sort of a combination of factors. I really felt I, you know, I wanted to accomplish like spending time abroad. I wanted to hopefully make a difference in terms of being a small piece of sitting at the table. I got to do a lot of those things. And I have to say that I think a lot of colleagues of mine, which continues to be the case today, were just a little bit, they weren't sure what the direction was at State Department. So, you know, there was a lot of friends of mine that were getting curtailed, meaning they wanted to be out in the field because they felt like they weren't getting a lot of direction from DC. And so a lot of like really, you know, I'd say sometimes bureaucracy, what happens to bureaucracy sometimes is that a lot of good ideas die. And I was always so cautiously optimistic, like, no, we can do it. And I started to feel that a little bit more. And so I thought it was just the right time to sort of take the next step, which is I was writing a lot. I wanted to do a lot more stuff, you know, in terms of speaking and writing. And so it just worked out.
Well, can I ask, like, after the election last year, at that point were you, I remember thinking that time, like I was kind of conflicted. And I heard the conversation among a lot of our DC friends and colleagues about, you know, having served in prior administrations, like, should we stick it through? Or the calculation was like, will this, is it worth serving the Dark Lord? Or should we stick around or should we just head out now? A number of folks did immediately like just head out. And but you did stick it through and I'm glad you did because I think it's important to have good folks. But how did you feel like after the election? Were you thinking about the same things as well?
Yeah, I went through a range of emotions after elections. You know, what I come back to is that I think the work in the field. So I always think of myself as somebody, you know, a lot of times there's a lot of focus even now right on DC, and that's understandable with everything going on. But having served in Islamabad and Afghanistan and in Europe, you know, I always think about the programming, those young people that we're trying to reach out to and work with those NGOs. And so I think it was just sort of, I still thought, you know, this is important to sort of to serve. The best way I can describe it is someone asked me soon after, maybe like a month or two afterwards, you know, there's a lot of, we weren't sure who's going to become the new secretary. And I was thinking about what to do. And I was like, you know, I'd like to stay on if I can, but, you know, I also was thinking about other things. And someone was like, well, why would you stay on? And I said, you know what? There's nothing like serving behind the flag. And I think that sort of summed up, you know, why I stayed and why I got hired onto this Secretary Tillerson's policy planning staff, because I always tried to say, look, I'm going to take a data-driven approach. I'm going to lay it out the facts. And when I interviewed with the team, that's the same thing I told them. So I said, look, I approach things in a very analytical way. So I'm going to tell you, based on my research and methodology, what I think is the right policy issue. And they said they wanted that. They wanted, you know, I said, look, a lot of my views might be contrarian, but it's based on solid research. And if you want that view in the room, you got me. If not, then you should choose someone else.
Did you feel like they wanted that voice in the room?
Yeah, they told me that. And I think for a while I felt that. You know, I got to write what I wanted to write. You know, I wasn't always successful in what I wrote, but I wrote a lot of contrarian memos. I was able to, you know, I was able to make a case for what I thought was important, or, you know, what I thought, even things as terms of terminology. You know, what do you call terrorism? What is the best way? What kind of program should we be funding? So I do feel like I was able to write and do things. Now, was I effective is a separate question. And I think, you know, I wouldn't grade myself as uber effective because a lot of things that I did propose or push for, you know, didn't get the kind of traction I thought.
Well, that's not just you, though. That would be a lot of folks, I'm sure, in the same boat. But now, can you tell us a little bit about your books? I mean, you're always writing, and it's amazing to me how you manage to do that.
Always trying to follow in your footsteps, Rabia. I've been fascinated by, so my early books, one was my doctoral dissertation, which was basically where I went. It's called Vying for Allah's Vote. And, you know, that's where I talked about young people. I went to camps, Al-Qaeda and Taliban camps, and I interviewed young people. My parents to this day still are like, they're like, hold on, us. Like, they're so worried. What the heck was I doing there?
Okay. So in your bio, I said that you wrote two recent books, but that you've written more than two books. You've written, what, four or five books?
Four books.
Okay.
So my first one just came out. Yeah. So the two early ones, one was about, you know, interviewing these young kids that, you know, that were in these camps. And basically I wanted to talk about their journey. Like, why would they, some kid from Southern Punjab, you know, which is the largest province in Pakistan, why would that kid want to travel, you know, 2,000 kilometers, you know, to go join these camps? So I wanted to interview them. And so I was looking at like organizationals and how do groups like Jashi Muhammad and Lashkar Taiba, whether it's these organizations, how do they thrive and flourish? And then for my second book, I wrote about, you know, again, coming from small town America, I always was faced with this question, like, you know, people thought of Pakistan and South Asia in a lot of ways, like we thought about the Soviet Union 50 years ago. So people would be like, explain to us the most dangerous place on earth. And I was like, well, you know, so I went there. And so this, that's my second book, which is called Bargain from the Bazaar, was a story of
it's
a family
book.
That I live with.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. It was a family I live with, and they had three sons. And I just told the story of these parents. And the main protagonist is the mother. She like holds everything together. So she's this amazing woman that kind of works and runs the family and tries to hold the family with all this chaos around her. The recent books that came out just recently, Countering Hate, which just came out, we launched at South by Southwest this past week, and Digital World War, which came out last November. Thank you. They both deal with sort of new media and this information, what I think of as an information battlefield, which is so much stuff. I mean, you get everything from Russian disinformation to this latest Facebook thing with the data being used in different ways to, you know, how non-state actors, groups like ISIS and others are using online to recruit, you know, both state and non-state actors of, you know, how they're using, how the Iranian regime might be shutting down, using their telecom providers to shut down access to Telegram or other apps that people use. So it's a whole gamut of things, but I really wanted to look at it from a data-driven perspective. How does this affect foreign policy? How does it affect, you know, everyday people?
Well, this is incredibly timely, relevant, and I can't wait to pick up the book and read how you're going to save us all, Haroon.
So I'll admit, when it comes to coffee, I haven't always been that cultured. And a lot of the time, I was okay with even instant coffee.
Oh my God, Susan.
But sometimes I'd upgrade and like get the brew. But like, I mean, it's coffee, and as long as it's hot, it's kind of okay, right?
It's kind of okay, but you know what? It's
Except,
not
no,
okay.
It's not.
Especially once you taste what really good coffee tastes like. And we're talking about the same coffee, and that's a Blue Bottle coffee.
Yeah, instant, it's got to go now, because Blue Bottle coffee shows you what home coffee can really taste like.
Blue Bottle coffee provides some of the most delicious coffee in the world, and they come right to your door. That's even the better part. I mean, for me, I understand how people are obsessed with certain like coffee chains. I don't have the time. I'm sorry, I just don't. I don't have the time or the patience to go out and get in my car, park, get in line to get a cup of coffee. I want my coffee in my house.
So Blue Bottle is both tasty and convenient, which means instant coffee has nothing left going for it.
And there's a reason for that. That's because Blue Bottle has an insane dedication to coffee. They search the planet far and wide to get exclusive relationships with independent growers all over the world, and they source only the most delicious and sustainable coffee there is. And nobody takes freshness as seriously as Blue Bottle either. That's why they roast and ship your coffee beans within 48 hours of placing your order, so they come right to you, and they have a subscription service, so you're never going to run out of it. So right now, for our listeners, hurry to bluebottlecoffee.com/45 to get $10 off of your first coffee subscription order. That's bluebottlecoffee.com/45. bluebottlecoffee.com/45. You just mentioned this news that came out this past week with Cambridge Analytica and Facebook. And you ready to dive in, Susan, into what happened this past week?
Let's not bury the lead here.
Oh, dear. All right.
The big news of this week is what happened to the top of state.
Is that the big news? See, I'm a little confused. Or is it McKay? But yeah, let's go.
Well,
let's
there's
start
a lot
state.
Of big state-relevant yeah. news. I think this counts as the big one.
Okay. All right.
So, and he finally did it. He finally fired Tillerson. Like, after, like, months and months of will he, won't he, like, stay tuned after the commercial to find out what happens next. He's like, okay, you're gone.
I received a call today from the President of the United States at a little after noontime from Air Force One, and I've also spoken to White House Chief of Staff Kelly to ensure we have clarity as to the days ahead. What is most important is to ensure an orderly and smooth transition during a time that the country continues to face significant policy and national security challenges. As such, effective at the end of the day, I'm delegating all responsibilities of the Office of the Secretary to Deputy Secretary of State Sullivan. My commission as Secretary of State will terminate at midnight, March the 31st. All of us we know want to leave this place as a better place for the next generation. I'll now return to private life as a private citizen, as a proud American, proud of the opportunity I've had to serve my country. God bless all of you. God bless the American people. God bless America.
And he fired him via tweet. Is this correct? Or was there first conversation beforehand? I've heard both things. I've also
I'd
heard
like to
that
hear
John
what
Kelly
his
had
version
a
is, because there are conflicting versions going on right now.
Yeah. Well, what do you know, Harun?
Well, from what I understand is that it was, there may have been some communication, you know, between like, you know, the chief of staff and Tillerson, you know, but it wasn't like clear. It was like, okay, at some point, you know, there might be a change, but because I think Tillerson himself also wasn't expecting to serve that much longer. I mean, he wasn't expecting, maybe he would serve maybe through the end of the, you know, summer to the fall. So it's not like
Why?
He was going to.
Why wasn't he expecting to serve longer?
I think that he, you know, and this goes back to why he took the job. You know, I think that he started to grow into the job. If you watched the last, I feel like the last press conference he did should have been the first one, you know, because it was starting to get closer to, you know, getting, explaining to people why he thought this was so important. I think one of his early interviews, he said something like, you know, my wife told me to.
Right.
And now that's a good answer in a lot of other things. But, you know, when you're talking about Secretary of State, you know, it's a little bit like, okay, we got it that your wife thought it was a good idea, but why mm-hmm. did you think it was a good idea? And I think, you know, people forget, I know that it sort of irritated him that, you know, he was the CEO of ExxonMobil. Now, for a lot of people
really
that don't come from the private sector.
Powerful man.
Yeah, exactly. So a lot of times in D.C., they're like, oh, yeah, okay, they just think, oh, yeah, some lobbying company, ExxonMobil, it's all the same. Okay, fine, you come from the private sector, big whoop. But ExxonMobil is like bigger than most countries. And when you run mm-hmm. ExxonMobil, it's like countries come to you. You are bigger than a head of state. And so, you know, I think people sent a lot of discount of that experience. And I know that it did bug him. And he was also, you know, the other thing I think that is interesting is that some people forget is that he's an engineer. So, and really explains so much of his personality. And in a lot of ways, you know, he reminds me of my dad, you know, and, you know, he thinks of things like an engineer, like very analytically. So when you're briefing him, when you're presenting things to him, he wants you to lead with the numbers. He thinks very much like equations. So he's a thinker, right? So he likes to read everything and, you know, grasp what you're presenting. But again, it's very much like, you know, he's kind of an introvert. And I think a lot of these things ended up hurting him in the job, because so much of what you do at Secretary of State is more than that. And it's not something that came naturally to him.
I remember early on, he made a statement about how it was something about him. So he had been doing the, you know, daily briefings like normal. And he mentioned something like, oh, I don't need that to function, or I don't need that kind of media attention, or I don't need to be in the news every day. And like, no one told him that the point of that isn't for his benefit, but for everyone else's.
Yeah. So, you know, I think that he had a general, he felt like,
he's,
you know,
CEO.
That, yeah, he's CEO, and previous secretaries of state, he thought had been too, you know, press focused or media focused or, you know, out there, you know? And so he wanted to be more of like, yeah, what he did at Exxon, which was he had 12 different units at Exxon that kind of reported up to him. And, you know, and so he was able to make big decisions. That's how he thought of himself. His success at Exxon was that he made big decisions. You know, he had the right, you know, kind of steer on things, on these big, massive decisions. And so I think he wanted to recreate that atmosphere of state. The problem is that, you know, one, and, you know, it's something that I don't think anyone has really picked up on, but he, not a single person on his staff at state ever worked with him before.
Oh,
so
okay.
I can't think of any Secretary of State in the past. You go back to like so many.
He didn't bring his own people.
No one, zero. So nobody that worked with him at state ever worked with him. He didn't bring anybody from Exxon. So you can imagine that's odd, right? Every Secretary of State brings one or two or 40 people. In the case of other secretaries, like you bring those people for a couple of reasons. One, you have loyalty and trust. They know you. They know the kind of things that you want, you know, that are helpful. And it's natural, right? This is like sort of in even the corporate and the sort of public sector, it's natural. And so I think it really hurt him, because he was not only having a new group of people, including his chief of staff and others, that had to learn about the way that he needed things, but he had to learn too. And I'm not sure that both figuratively and literally, if these people would have taken a bullet for him, you know, because mm-hmm. they were maybe loyal to the campaign or other folks. And so it just hurts your ability to get work done. And I think that's something that, you know, he miscalculated.
from the outside, it seems like, I mean, I don't know a lot about his staff and stuff, that the biggest hindrance to his work was really the president himself. So can I want to, I remember while you were serving as advisor to him, I asked you a couple of times, like, how is he? How is it working with him? And actually, your responses were pretty positive. You said he's a nice guy. He's been, which was interesting because we were, there were a lot of reports coming out of State Department that people are very demoralized. They were just not happy with him. They didn't want to work with him. So I want to ask a little bit about your experience personally working with him, and then how he was dealing with, and how State Department was dealing with, like, completely contrary messages coming out of the White House.
You know, yeah, I have to say my experiences with him, he is, and this is the, and this is unfortunate because a lot of people didn't get to know, he didn't really make himself vulnerable. Actually, I, you know, I thought about this when I watched the last press conference. I was like, boy, I wish he had done more.
That was emotional. It was emotional.
Yeah. You know, it's like Brene Brown talks about this, like, make yourself vulnerable because that's authentic. And I think people think when you show your weaknesses that that's a bad thing, but it actually makes you more human and actually allows you to relate to people. And I think, and one-on-one, he was a lot more pragmatic, a lot more down. He was pretty down to earth. He was very self-deprecating, for example. He, I thought, was intellectually curious. Like, he was very open about, well, I don't know about this. I don't know about that. And he was open to receiving contrarian information, right? As long as it was, you know, data-driven, right? So I think that was his big thing. Again, he's an
engineer.
That's
great to hear,
so
that's actually.
His bias. Yeah. So in that sense, I thought it was good. Now, where I think he, again, where things became difficult is that he thought that he shouldn't be involved in the bureaucratic turf fights. So early on, when it came to things with the NSC or with Jared Kushner or others, he kind of just ceded ground, saying, fine, no problem. You know, you want to go do that thing in Saudi Arabia? You want to go do that thing there? Fine, go ahead. Typically, you know, a secretary might be like, no, run everything through me and my team.
Yeah.
And so I think that, you know, that, so that started to, you know, make more of a gap with the White House. And then I think he also wasn't so concerned about the public narrative. But again, I think that was, you know, public narratives are important to the extent that
in state more than anyone else, really.
Yeah, exactly. And there was a small circle that he had kind of built at the top. We used to joke, it's Mahogany Row, which is the seventh floor. And people say the seventh floor is closest to heaven, which is the top floor of the State Department. And having served there, I can't say it's closest to heaven, but it is nice. You know, you're in these cushy offices and these little cubicles. But I think that, you know, the problem was that a lot of information wasn't going downwards or, you know, to the other floors and then literally outwards to the field. We have, you know, hundreds of embassies and consulates around the world. And so what happened is that people got the sense that, wait a minute, you know, what is our mission? What is our duty? We're not hearing from anybody. You know, there's, and this is the thing that you said, Susan, like he was like, you know, we don't need to do press briefings. We don't need to do the same kind of outreach, you know? And so I think that led to a lot of like water cooler talk where people were just like, what is going on? Why aren't they appointing people? Why isn't someone reading my memo? And so I think that led to, you know, people just feeling like uninspired.
Tillerson is one of these odder, more interesting stories out of the Trump cabinet to me, because he is, I was going to say one of the few, but I don't know if one of the, not one of the only, one of like maybe two, who is undeniably competent in his area as it was, like not his cabinet area, but like where he came from. Like he wasn't good, like you don't get to be where he was if he was not really good at his job. And theoretically, he had skills that, while not a perfect match, should have translated more or less over. And they just didn't. It's not a case like DeVos where she's like incompetent. It doesn't
completely
matter where you put her.
Unqualified,
she's
going to
suck.
Right.
This guy should have been able to lead organization. And I guess it does demonstrate kind of empirically that like running a business is not the same as running a government agency. And you can't just translate the skill sets. But what you said about the turf war does seem to explain a lot, because in state, I mean, you can't really operate unless you were trusted to be the voice of American foreign policy. And he didn't fight to be that voice. He fought to be another one in the crowd.
Well, I think he thought that he would just do – he was like a quiet warrior. So he would just go ahead and do his work behind the scenes. So he thought that, you know, he had his confidence in his own ability and his teams. And I think what happened, though, is that the public narrative started to overtake, you know, what the work, you know, they were trying to do. And I think go back and, for example, he would do more town halls. He would do – he was actually quite good when he went down to, like, our lunchtime. You know, we have a big cafeteria at State. I think, Robbie, you might have seen it. Susan, you might have seen it.
Oh, I got to eat there a few times because of you, Haroon, and that's one reason I'm really sad you're not there anymore. I got to meet Richard Holbrooke there.
And the good thing wasn't the food, but it was a company. But right. You know, I think that a couple times, I think one time he went down there and he did like went around and talked to people and he was a hit, you know, like it was just, yeah. You know, and I think that he realized like he should have done that more because, you know, he wasn't as visible as other secretaries. And, you know, these are his, as I call, loafers on the ground. So these are his folks that, you know, are ready to stand up and follow the mission that he had laid out. And so I think, you know, I think going back, he probably regrets it a little bit. At least, I mean, from his last press conference, he seemed to indicate that what he said on the record. So I do think that, you know, this is the thing that is such a paradox about this. He didn't need this job. He was, you know, his obituary / like tombstone would read the great American CEO. Like right. He got to the top of one of the greatest American companies, one of the global companies that's bigger. I mean, people don't realize how big ExxonMobil. In fact, when Exxon and Mobil merged, it was one of the biggest mergers in the world that he oversaw. Okay. That was like a massive merger. You know, mm-hmm. We're talking their cap and assets is like, again, bigger than, you know, countries put together. And so, you know, this is kind of like a cherry on top. It wasn't supposed to define him. Mm-hmm. And I think that what happened is that it started to define him. And if you notice, you go back, you know, he started to find his voice a little bit. You know, let's say Charlottesville. This was really, for me, iconic at the time because he's very methodical. You know, when he did his interviews, you know, he didn't do that many interviews. He didn't do that much public stuff. But he came out on the Sunday morning talk shows and he distanced himself from a lot of the Charlottesville stuff. And he said something along the lines of, you know, the president speaks for himself, you know, before the president had come out and then, you know, condemned or, you know, some of the things are going on. So, you know, you saw him kind of, and part of that, I think, was that he was getting pressure from a lot of his colleagues to sort of say, look, Rex, what you don't realize is that this could stain, you know, your entire legacy. This could be the way that people remember you, not as the ExxonMobil CEO. And sadly, I do think that to some extent, that's what's happened.
Of course it will. Once you join up with Trump, that's it for you. If you give up your dignity and you compromise yourself to work for him, you're not going to get rewarded for it. And that's all you'll be from then on. We see it over and over again. But okay, so Tillerson obviously has a human side. He was not incompetent in general. But for this job, he did act incompetent at the time, or at least he acted like he was trying to gut state from within. Where was that coming from? Was that like his like impulse to like cut back government in general? But like why slash and burn state of all places?
Right. So here's where I think this is where this miscalculation that he made. Here's the interesting thing. He loves redesigns, reorganizations, whatever you want to call it.
Engineers.
This is like it's a thing that he thought he did very well. And in fact, he's mentioned it, you know, a couple of times that there were three big redesigns or organizational efforts that he made. One was a lot of people forget he was the head of Boy Scouts of America, oversaw that, and they went through a whole redesign. Then obviously the ExxonMobil merger, and then another reorganization of ExxonMobil itself. And so, you know, he felt that that was one of his strengths. Now, the thing is that there's no doubt that there needs to be, and there's always room for changes at state. I mean, I'll be the first person to admit it, that, you know, there's processes and there's better efficiency that we can achieve. It's very kind of, you know, I always joke that at State Department, there's more people that say no to something that can say yes to something, right? So the layers that you have to go through, like we have, like, give you one pointing example. Like when you write a memo, you know, you have to clear it. Clear it means, you know, you have to get all these offices to sign off on it. But you can imagine, so you write this 2-page memo and you have like 15 people that have to, at the end of the memo, they write, okay, they can make their edits. You can imagine what it looks like after, you know, 15 people, you know, tackle a document and cut stuff out and add, you know, like, what does it say, actually? It doesn't, it's sort of like chop suey. It's a little bit like, you know,
Frankenstein.
Totally. It's like, you know, and you're like, what? Like different headline sentences, different, like literally parts of the memo are arguing against itself sometimes. So it's kind of like an adjudication process. You got to be like a, you know, tour de force editor to like kind of figure out how to weave. So things like that, of course, like this is any bureaucracy. I think what happened, though, is that he started off sort of thinking, you know, in mind a certain percentage to cut, and then they kind of went to the roadmap, you know, like, oh, let's cut 30% or 20% or something like that. And then instead of sort of, I think, asking the question of where are the areas that you can go ahead and do it, make those reforms, and then, you know, how do you get there? And I think, you know, also it wasn't communicated as directly to all the personnel. So like a lot of people just didn't know what was going on. So everyone thought every water cooler talk was, hey, is my department going to get cut? So everyone's kind of anxious. And so, you know, and then the other thing too is that these reforms always take a long time. And, you know, even by his own admission, his last press conference, he said, look, I don't think we got there in terms of modernizing it. It takes a long time. It's a hard thing to do right off the bat because you'll probably never see the benefits of it, right? So you might do all these reforms. It's like when Colin Powell was secretary, he did a lot of IT reforms, you know, especially like upgrading our technology, you know, moving now we take for granted the smartphone revolution, but he really armed diplomats with a lot of new technology. But, you know, it took years. And a lot of the reforms he started ended up helping other secretaries. So it's like it's also one of those things that you will never see the direct benefits for. So if that's your flagship thing, like it will never be the credit will actually never be given to you. And in fact, you'll just take all the downside. So it's one of those things that maybe he didn't recognize coming in that it would take a lot longer than he imagined. And by the way, those reforms, when they take place, you know, will be under someone else's watch.
They will. But the other thing is this, I mean, to me, those because the reforms themselves seem not just drastic, but also badly thought out, considering the mission of the State Department. Maybe it was better for him not to be around when they actually when the effects kicked in. I mean, the effects already seemed like, you know, it wasn't doing too well.
It's like he never really got the point of it. Like what
the point
what
of the state yeah,
goal of state is
of diplomacy. Yeah. Can I ask you? Were you shocked when you heard that he was fired and how he was fired? He seemed to me in his statement, he seemed really shook to me. He did.
Right. I think he was. I wasn't shocked. I mean, part of what I just thought that I had seen the gap when I was there emerge, you know, between what we were doing and what other in the interagency were doing. So I wasn't surprised, even the manner that it happened. I think that he had probably come to think that he had waited out the sort of the worst of it. And, you know, meaning like, you know, and I, again, this is so interesting. The one thing that I knew that he really did care deeply about was his exit. He wanted to kind of control his narrative on his exit. And it's ironic that the one thing that he wanted to control was the one thing that was also taken away from him, you know? Mm. And so, that's also why it, I think it really stung. And you're right. I think the press conference, he was, you could see him. He was vulnerable. And I heard in other conversations he had with staff, he was very, very kind of like nostalgic about things that they weren't able to get done together. And again, I always think, boy, if you just had that at the beginning.
Yeah. He didn't say a word about Trump. He said nothing about the president.
And yet every word was about Trump, too.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about the incoming Secretary of State.
Whoa. Before we get there, the other part. His firing. So, okay, yes, he was fired suddenly through a tweet, but not just through a tweet, because Trumpism at its core is humiliation and control. And I mean, this is like the most disgusting story, not about Kelly, General Kelly, John Kelly, and the way he fired Trump.
Right.
And the fact that he publicly shared that Rex Tillerson was on the toilet when he fired him.
So this is a very non-Kelly move. It was
no,
so
No, I think
weird.
It's very Kelly.
Really?
I think that's who he is at his core. I think that's who the man is.
But this is never, he's never done anything like this before.
Because he was military before. Now he's not military.
No. I mean, as chief of staff.
Yes.
Has he been?
Look how he handled soldiers.
Charlottesville, yes. Charlottesville.
And the soldier who was shot in Niger.
Oh, you're right. Yeah. They're okay.
This is who Kelly is. He embraces Trumpism and is it. And he is as petty and cruel as his master.
Yeah, that was a humiliating. It was completely unnecessary for him to tell the press about that conversation.
Yeah, I mean, I think the one thing that jumps out to me is that, you know, it just tells you the distance, you know, both figuratively and literally. Like, Tillerson was halfway around the world giving the press conference, you know, and someone asked a question about North Korea. And he was like, look, we're far ways off from any sort of direct meeting, right? This is what both him and his team had put together, like, sort of talking points. And then, you know, that decision literally almost at the same time was reversed. And so I think that divergence had been growing over time. And it is so emblematic of how things ended. And I think that he didn't recognize the consequences of, I think that he thought to himself, look, we can continue doing our work, you know, as long as we're not wading into all these political turf wars or whatnot, I'll quietly do my work. I don't think he realized that the gap, those strategic decisions he made at the early on, you know, I study game theory, it's called path dependence, that essentially those every increment of those pivotal moments becomes bigger every as you move on. And I just think that he miscalculated that.
And then when he called Trump a fucking moron, I think the path to penance was pretty much solidified there.
This is what I've been trying to figure out. What was the straw that broke this camel's back? Why this moment? What happened that Trump said, now this is when I'm firing him?
He condemned Russia.
Okay.
You know,
okay.
I think I'm not sure there was like a moment per se, because I think there was talk of this for a while. So, right. So I think part of it was that there was conversation of this happening, you know, for a while.
There's speculation every time. I think there was a divergence between.
I think it was the North Korea thing, because it just made us look so out of step. Your key diplomat, your number one person for foreign policy, was saying something diametrically opposed. I think that sort of just, you know, a lot of the other leaders were like, whoa, you know, I think what started happening is other leaders started to say, you know, does the secretary speak on behalf of the U.S. government? You know, and I think that became a big question for a lot of folks, like, is he out of step? And so I'm not sure there was a moment, but it was definitely, to me, like, pretty stark.
It is interesting, though, that the moment it happened is right after Tillerson comes out and condemns Russia's attacks on the U.K.
Right. I think the White House started to come around, you know, started to later on then sort of seemed to confirm, but was reluctant to do right off the bat.
Do you run your own business? Because if you do, I know like a lot of folks who work from home, and I am one of those people. It's really great to work from home, but it's always not the most convenient or professional thing because you can't really meet clients in your home. I mean, you've got like kids and animals and dishes and all kinds of things, and it just doesn't look great. Well, DaVinci is your solution because DaVinci offers incredibly affordable meeting rooms in well-known office locations in every single city. With their platform, you can find the perfect meeting room for your face-to-face business meeting as easy as search, book, and meet. That's all you gotta do. You gotta search online, book your room, and meet up. And whether you need a day office or a conference room, a boardroom, or training space, they have all kinds of spaces for your need. Let's say you're based in Phoenix, but you need to meet customers face-to-face in New York or LA or Omaha, wherever. Well, skip the coffee shops, because you know what? That don't look professional. Get a DaVinci meeting room instead. It's fast, it's affordable, and again, it's as easy as search, book, and meet. They've got instant access to over 5,000 affordable meeting rooms in well-known office locations in every single city. It's gonna make you look good, it's gonna make your business look good, you're gonna impress your clients. The DaVinci rooms come with high-speed internet, all the presentation tools you need to make your next meeting a success, and all of it starts at only $10 an hour. $10. All you gotta do is remember three words: search, book, and meet. Now, for our listeners, if you go to DaVinciMeet.com/45 for a limited time, you're gonna get 50% off your first purchase, 50% off your first booking. That's DaVinciMeet.com/45. Do not miss out on this offer. That's 50% off your first purchase. Terms and conditions apply. See DaVinciMeet.com/45 for details. Okay, so mixed feelings at State about Tillerson. How do you think the folks feel about Pompeo at State?
You know, the best word to describe it is cautiously optimistic. I think people are, you know, it's less about Pompeo, although it's some about Pompeo, but more about, you know, because Tillerson, I think, had set, at least for a lot of people, had set a low bar, people are just excited that there's a change. And I think that they're, a lot of Foreign Service officers do feel that Pompeo will, you know, be more responsive and will do more things to sort of bring them on board. And at least the early signs are that he will. He's there at State Department today. They started doing some handover. So he's actually, I think this is his first day as the designee.
So he doesn't have to be confirmed. Wait a minute. Just a quick question. He doesn't have to be confirmed before he becomes Secretary of State here.
What I think is, technically he doesn't, because he's a cabinet member, but there's only a portion of time that they're allowed to do that. Like, you can only slide someone in over for like a limited duration.
Nine months, I think.
Yeah, I think it's like that. So they are going to confirm him. Okay. So I think his hearings are, I don't know if they've announced it, but sometime in April, and he will do it. But technically he wouldn't have to, but I think they just want to do it all in the beginning. So anyways, he's doing some of his briefings today, and I would say generally people are looking forward, because I think they feel that, you know, that he understands a little bit of the pulse, at least of like doing the glad handing. Like, that's the one thing also I think the Secretary Tillerson made a mistake on, was that he, you know, I think his first couple of trips, he didn't go and really spend a lot of time or any time with embassy staff. See, and the thing is that foreign service officers, especially the senior force, they talk among themselves. So when you don't go to a post, whether it's in China or wherever you make your visit, and you go there, and look, it's not the sexiest thing in the world to do, but it's so important because it sends a signal saying, hey, folks, thanks for your sacrifice. Thanks for your hard work. You know, I always joke that foreign service officers, look, we'll never be honored at, you know, a NASCAR event or at the halftime of like an NBA game, right? It's just not going to happen, right? We're not the military. People don't have the same kind of reverence for the work that diplomats do, although I might argue that they should. And so, you know, there's always this chip. So these kind of things go a long way. If you just go and you're saying, hey, you know, inside a political section or economic section or whatever, public diplomacy section, you're saying, hey, thanks for the work you guys do. And I know it's hard and under tough circumstances. And a lot of times without your families, because a lot of these posts, you can't take your families or kids. So it's a lot of sacrifice. And so I think that he didn't do that early on. And so that spread kind of went viral in the department. And it didn't look good, right? Because it just showed that he doesn't get it. You know, he doesn't understand that, like, this is his bread and butter. And so I think I think Pompeo being a, you know, obviously coming from the Hill, he would be more attuned to doing that type of thing. And this is life as a politician. So I just think in that respect, he will do this kind of signals that people will be like, okay, got it. You know, feel like we're back on the map.
But do you feel any sense of concern or alarm that first of all, it seems that Pompeo is very much in lockstep with Trump, which maybe I'm sure that's what the president wants. But also, I don't know how he can carry on his duties as, you know, the chief representative of the United States around the world when Trump pivots on a dime and how that wouldn't create friction. But the other thing is, Pompeo has a troubling history with anti-Muslim, you know, bias and his associations with organizations like Frank Gaffney's group, like Act for America. I mean, these are like the major Islamophobes in that industry. And now he's going to have a chief diplomat to work with, you know, all kinds of Muslim majority countries across the Middle East. And I wonder how smoothly that'll go.
Yeah. So I think it's to be seen. I think that one thing that I hope happens that we'll see is I hope that he brings in, as part of his inner circle, you know, he brings in senior foreign service. So he brings in career people that he trusts that can help him understand where the levers are of policy. Because I think that, you know, we always say that the success for a Secretary of State is, you know, are you the State Department Secretary of State or are you the White House's Secretary of State? And, you know, to be really successful, you have to command and you have to be able to leverage your team. And I hope that he does that, but that's always going to be the tension because he, of all the cabinet members, has spent the most time with the president, you know, in the briefings and had a, you know, second office in the Eisenhower building. And so the key here is like, you know, bringing career people on. I think some of these things, I hope early on he will clarify or disavow anything, you know, I write about obviously anti-Semitism and Islamophobia in my new book, Countering Hate. And I hope that he, when he comes on board, you know, quickly signals to folks both internally at state and the communities that we're working on in the world that those are views that are not part of how we express ourselves, how we tell America's story. So, you know, I think that, you know, he has a big mandate, you know, big responsibility coming on, and he's going to have to navigate this sort of the ability to do what the White House wants him to do, and then how does he win over people at state? And the useful hook here, actually, I think, actually, is this national – a lot of people don't talk about this, but the national security strategy, which Nadia Shadlow helped put together, which I do think has some good framework in it, right? It talks about moving to sort of state actors, you know, away from just transnational non-state actors. Threats, you know, so it talks about like, you know, Russia and China, which I think is good and important, right? Because we focus all on ISIS and
ISIS,
and so that's good. And I think, and it also gives, there's a section in there for the first time, I actually would say it's called information statecraft, which talks about the stuff that I write about on the information battlefield, but it talks about how we need to think about public diplomacy in new ways and reaching new audiences. So I think if he is able to like focus on that, you know, and help implement that, then that will be good. But it's a tall order. It's not going to be easy.
So one concerning sign from his tenure at CIA is that apparently he had a reputation for never telling Trump no. And that in those briefings, anything Trump didn't like, he didn't push. He just pulled back. He kept – Trump likes him because Pompeo kept Trump happy.
Yeah. Well, I think, again, this is, I think, where Pompeo will have to just, you know, he'll have to do some organizational jiu-jitsu. You know, he's going to have to – at the end of the day, he has to be able to – you know, you have a whole team now that you're commanding. And if he learns from what Tillerson did or from what Tillerson didn't do, that, I think, provides a good roadmap for how do you, early on in your tenure, establish rapport with career foreign service and bring them into the decision-making process early on. And if you do that, then, you know, you do buy yourself some sort of political capital, social capital. If you don't, then it's really hard to be able to carry out your policy. I mean, the State Department, a lot of people don't realize, it's like a starfish model. You know, we think the best work is done in D.C. It's not. The best work is done out at our embassies. And people don't recognize this, but, you know, ambassadors have what we call chief of mission authority. So they are the president's principal representative in a country, and they are the ones that determine policy or help carry out policy in that country for the most part. And so it's almost like, if you think about it, like, so the starfish model is like, it's almost like you have 160 plus startups around the world, and then you have this, that it ties back somehow to DC. And so you really have to sort of think differently. It's not like command and control. It's definitely not like, you know, and I think that's what's going to be different. It's not like West Point, and it's not like being in DOD. So you have a different strategy. It will work at state, and I hope that he does that early on.
Would you go back?
You know, I would go back. I mean, I still believe in the mission, but, you know, I've also – there's a lot of good people there. There's a lot of really good folks there, and I still think that it's important work that he's done on the ground, and I focus less on D.C. and what's actually happening in the field. So, you know, I would do that because I think, you know – whether you talk about the Syria crisis, some of the work that we're doing at refugee camps in Jordan, which I've been to, which is so critical, heartbreaking, but it's important. You know, whether it's working with civil society groups, you know, post Arab Spring, where people are just like totally demoralized, or working with groups like, you know, Nahdlatul Ulama in Indonesia and other places, which is the largest civil society, one of the largest civil society organizations in the world. So I do because I love serving in the field, and I think there's still room to do really good stuff. You know, and I think that a lot of really good people are out there trying to do the work. So I hope that the new leadership recognizes that. And then, you know, a lot of the best ideas are already out there. You don't have to reinvent stuff, you know, and if you negotiate this well, then the State Department will be put back on the map.
Awesome. So I think, I mean, it's their loss for now, but it's good to know that you're still in the wings whenever they need you. We're going to move on since we spent quite a lot of time and there's a lot more news to cover this week, but that was a great conversation. Thank you so much for like telling us about your experience and giving us a little bit of a glimpse into, you know, some of the real issues that were happening. It does provide a more nuanced perspective of Tillerson as a human being and some of the challenges he was dealing with at state. So let's see what Pompeo brings to the organization. So Susan, where would you like to go next?
Gosh, let's start last Tuesday with Pennsylvania.
Right. Connor Lamb. You know, I think that he was able to tap into, you know, I mean, having grown up, parts of his district are very similar to where I grew up. And, you know, I think that, you know, people are fed up with Washington. So I think a lot of people forget that there's some real grievances, you know, on the ground. And I think that Lamb, if you see the way that he campaigned, you know, there's a lot of interesting similarities to he ran as an outsider. He ran as somebody that he didn't come across as overly, I mean, I don't know if ideological is the right word, but I mean, he didn't make, you know, he was nuanced on a lot of issues, right? Mm-hmm. In a way that was like, that spoke to local audiences. You know, I watched some of his like, you know, some of his like pitches and campaign stumps. And, you know, it's interesting kind of like how he's so empathetic. I think he has very high EQ, you know, in terms of how he came across. And it's a roadmap, right? Because I think he was able to, if you look at the coalition that he put together, he pulled in a lot of independents. He pulled in a lot of Republicans. He got a lot of people to cross over.
Harun, it's interesting that you're talking about this in terms of what Connor Lamb brought to the situation. I was thinking, could almost any candidate, any Democratic candidate have won this? Because, I mean, the fact that he won a district in which, Trump won by 20%, I mean, to me, was also a referendum on Trump. It was a referendum on the GOP leadership. It wasn't only about what Lamb was able to offer, but it was also a vote against something.
It was probably a combination, but Lamb also did run a good campaign for his district. I don't think we're at the point where you can sub in any random Democrat and in Western Pennsylvania you're getting the victory. But I mean, I really did enjoy watching how before the election, they were trying to paint Lamb as a Pelosi Schumer puppet. And then after the election, they're like, oh, he's basically a Republican anyway.
That's what that was one of the most amazing pivots ever. Yeah, that he's actually a conservative. It was like a victory for them. Actually, didn't somebody tweet? I can't remember. I shared a tweet by somebody that said that this was basically a conservative win.
Yeah, and he was. I mean, that was interesting kind of as an argument. I mean, it's not the case, actually, because he was very much like a lot of issues that he was talking about were not aligned
right.
with, but again, I think the interesting, if you look at it, I think of it like, remember last year when we had the that district race in Atlanta, the special election in the Atlanta suburbs with Ossoff and Handel. And I think that it's interesting kind of to juxtapose that against, that also. But I think what Lamb did was, again, and then he I do think he deserves a lot of credit, because it's one thing to sort of mobilize people's frustration or discontent, right? You have to speak to some of their issues, and yeah, it does say something about how the district flipped, but I think a lot of it was, again, how he made it a referendum about those grievances and getting things done. Because look, I think the motto for 2018 midterms should be, GSD, get stuff done. And I think I just feel like people are frustrated by the lack of movement on stuff. And that's what's going to be key. Whoever they think can carry that out, I think they'll vote for.
Well, going back a bit to more state related things, what also happened this week, shortly after Lamb's election, we had that fundraiser that Trump gave. And it reminded me a lot in some ways of the Tillerson, not in a different way, the Tillerson issue. But like a week before this fundraiser speech, Trudeau, Canada's guy, had an interview on some channel, and he talked about how he and Trump had a good working relationship. And the reporter challenged him and said, well, he doesn't keep his word a lot. Like, how do you deal with that? And Trudeau said, no, he keeps his word with me, I found. So, of course, a few days later, Trump has to go. And like, you give any endorsement to Trump, you give any kind of like sign of like siding with him, and he's instantly going to humiliate you for it. Mm. And Trump tells this ridiculous story about how he was talking to Trudeau about tariffs. And he just made up a number about what the supposed deficit was and was confirmed right by some anonymous aide, even though he was wrong, actually. And he tells us openly and brags about how he lied to Trudeau, essentially.
He thinks this is a mark of a good negotiator. Basically, yeah. Just, this is the way to lying. Get what you want, even if you have to just make it. And what was interesting to me about that, if you watch the video clip, it's like he doesn't realize it's a public event. He thinks he's like sitting in his living room talking to a couple of buddies and it's never going to get out. And why the inappropriateness of what he's actually admitting to, it just doesn't even occur to him.
How do you do foreign policy in that environment?
I think that's what Tillerson tried to take on, and obviously, like translator in chief, sort of.
Until Trump contradicts it. And that's the thing. How do you translate somebody who you don't even know if what he's saying is true, but also he continuously changes his opinions on things.
Yeah. I mean, this is a challenge that HR and Nadia and others that work at the NSC, and they continue to sort of, they take those broad strokes. And again, I think where I've found those folks to be most successful is they sort of work underneath the layer of media, and there's all these stuff that's going on in sort of Twitter sphere and all the proclamations. And then they quietly try to continue to put together these PCCs, which is like a, meeting at the high level on substantive foreign policy issues, and then working with the state. I think, again, where it started to hurt was that Tillerson and a lot of the team didn't have a seat at the table at a lot of those meetings because of the divergence. So that's where you saw it grow over time. And the hope is that Pompeo will hopefully be there, given his proximity.
Well, it's worth noting that the whole story that Trump told about lying to Trudeau was apparently itself a lie and never happened. I don't know if that's better or worse, or just more chaos. So he just made up a story to make himself look good about lying to a foreign leader, which didn't happen. And he also told a lie about bowling balls, which...
He's actually repeated the story numerous times, apparently. The bowling ball story. This wasn't the only time. So he keeps talking about how in Japan they use bowling balls to test like the strength of their cars. They'll drop a bowling ball off, and if it doesn't dent, I don't even understand what's happening here and what the context was. But
I don't understand either. But one thing that I love, I do love to bowl. Coming from small town America, like when people ask me what I did for fun, like it was, and I have to like between that and listening to country music, it's I love to bowl.
Oh my God, are you a country boy at heart too?
I'm so much. I drove a truck growing up. That's all true.
So that was a bowling ball story. There's some more stuff we're going to talk about, right? Before we wrap up, we got to talk
about...
All right,
I'm going to run through rapid fire. We had McKinty, Trump's body man, get dragged out of the White House without his jacket because apparently, it's still kind of unclear, some kind of possibly financial crimes or probably just really heavy gambling, like tens of thousands of dollars worth of gambling. But he's gone. He's one of the originals, out with Hope Hicks. There's like no one left now. We have Trump Jr. divorcing. We have Scavino, Trump's Twitter guy, divorcing. We have Roger Stone, who apparently has two people now come forward to say that he knew about WikiLeaks and the emails before anyone else did. One of those sources is Sam Nunberg, so, you know.
There's that.
But the other one's anonymous. And from the way it was phrased, it seems like someone much more credible, which is why they even reported this. And I kind of wonder if it's Gates. We also got, let's see, Papadopoulos. Apparently, in his testimony, he described how Sessions had encouraged him to meet with Putin, or set the Putin meeting. And then for Sessions, we have three witnesses who say that he lied in that meeting because he said, well, first he said he didn't recall it. Well, at first he said it never happened. Then he said never called it. And then he said he didn't recall it. If he did, he'd recall shutting down Papadopoulos' suggestion. Of course, now we have three people come forward to say that actually, no, he encouraged it. He was all about this Putin-Trump meeting. And then we have a bunch of drama that happened after Tillerson being fired, with McMaster going to get fired, according to Washington Post, but he's not fired.
And then Kelly was supposed to be fired.
But he's not fired yet. And then I think they're trying to fire Shulkin from Veterans Affairs and Ben Carson from Housing. And
what, really? Ben Carson?
Apparently they're also
his
on the list.
Sleepy self? That's because he lied about the, son of a bitch.
Because he lied about the plates.
Oh, come
so
on.
So that's, okay, now we'll go back to the slowdown a bit. Let's go to McCabe.
Somebody did get fired.
I can't believe I just did like a rapid fire run through like these major like week-long scandals.
Major stories, yeah.
But that's where we are. So McCabe.
So McCabe happens, but can we talk about what happened right before McCabe was fired?
That
Mueller sent a subpoena to the Trump Organization.
Oh yeah. Well, we don't know when it happened, but it was sometime recently. Trump Organization receives a subpoena asking for lots of documents, including ones related to Trump Russia, which, you know, of course he did. So it was going to happen eventually. I'm not sure we can read too much into it, but it's a sign that things are moving very quickly.
I mean, that
along.
Would be a normal part of this kind of investigation. So now, you know, the theory is that McCabe is a potential witness against Trump in terms of like the obstruction charges, Russia stuff. And so Trump is trying to discredit potential witnesses in an investigation that is like hanging like a sword over his head. And so McCabe gets fired by Sessions.
This is going to be a complicated story. It's going to play out for a long time because all the factors involved. But McCabe is one of like the three biggies who could be witnesses of the obstruction investigation. And Trump is now like trying to discredit and fire them all. But McCabe spent the last, I think, 90 days on leave because he had some built up time off with the goal of retiring yesterday, Sunday, with his pension, full pension. Only like 26 hours before that happened, he gets fired by Sessions. But here's what's complicated here. What we know is that there was an IG's report, the investigator general, who recommended his firing. And Horowitz is known to be like, he's not a flunky. He's not like a Trumpist. From what I've heard and seen, he's pretty solid. So if he's recommending McCabe's firing, there could be more to the story. Of course, Sessions being the one to fire him when he's recused is ridiculous, but probably necessary for Sessions if he wants to stay on.
But how about the manner of it? I mean, like, if he was going to leave in 2 days, I guess, was there no other way to sanction the man after 26 years of service to take away his pension? Seems kind of petty.
It is, but we don't know yet what he did, what the report found he did. Although we didn't know, ironically, it appears that his wrongdoing, so to speak, was against Hillary and helped Trump.
Right. So, okay. So the lack of candor is the charge against him. And that specifically means what? What does lack of candor mean?
It's not lying. It's not that we're not talking about like perjury here. We're not talking about that sort of standard. It's a part of why it's hard for people in his position to get up and testify before Congress because they're not just be able to like lawyer it. They can't get away with like weasel wording their way out. and it's a kind of fuzzy standard, but they're required to have candor, to be open, not evasive, not to dodge questions or not to give answers that could be misleading. So it makes them very vulnerable. And reportedly, he was not, and this is all rumors and leaks. We don't have a report yet, and hopefully we will. But supposedly he was not fully forthcoming about the extent of leaks against Hillary Clinton, authorized leaks against Hillary Clinton during the election.
Okay, so, but he's lawyered up now. You know, McCabe is lawyered up now, and it sounds like he's fighting back. He's denying the allegations. I think there is a process in which he can appeal the firing, correct? And he reports that he has memos of his conversations with Trump, which Trump actually tweeted about. And that was another thing. Right after this happened, on Friday he gets fired. On Saturday, Trump for the first time tweets directly about Mueller and the investigation.
He tweeted Mueller's name for the first time. We've entered a new phase of the Trump-Russia investigation.
Not the last time. I'm guessing we're going to see a lot more of that. So this is directly tied. This is directly tied to, you know, it has to be.
It's directly tied in two ways. Like, he also, he threaded those tweets together. We're going to have litigation over whether threaded tweets mean things are related or not.
Right.
They're going to have to argue. Trump's going to have to argue in court that, like, he just threaded those two tweets, the one about McCabe and the one about the Mueller investigation, because he's a dumb shit and not because he meant to thread them.
It's a fair argument.
That's his legal defense. I buy it. I think that's very plausible. And I don't necessarily doubt the claim, but
he doesn't know how Twitter works.
We're now going to have to litigate how much of a dumb shit on Twitter the president is.
Yeah. I mean, it could be a defense, but the truth is that, yeah, absolutely, these things are related. Let's not be crazy here. Of course we know they're related. So we didn't talk about Stormy.
Well, there'll be more Stormy next week, I'm sure.
There'll be more Stormy next week. But very quickly, Trump has countersued.
The forecast is stormy weather for a while yet.
Trump has countersued Stormy for $20 million. It's all about the NDA that doesn't actually exist. And speaking of NDAs, it was just recently reported that the White House has asked their staff to sign NDAs in which $10 million, you know, they'd be penalized if they broke the NDA. Here's my question to you. Haroon, as somebody who has served in government for so long, is this like a thing? Have you ever heard of this before?
NDAs?
Signing NDAs?
Civil servants?
I haven't.
It's not a thing.
I need to... I don't know. Actually, this is all new because you guys are lawyers, you know, par excellence. So you guys can tell me about how this works. But no.
Well, you have the experience. Like, Tillerson didn't make you sign an NDA saying you can't talk about me when you leave, right? That didn't happen.
No, we didn't. No, I mean, the only thing we have is that there's like classified information. We can't breach that if there's something classified or top secret. But you know, that's the only one I know of.
I do think they've been heating up for a while all throughout 2018, but we're definitely on high alert now for serious stuff going down. Trump wants to fire Mueller. He's in restraint yet. He's been held back before, but there's just signs of more chaos coming out of the White House, and it could be any time. It could be this week. And if it is, go find your local protest and join it.
Well, two of his lawyers just contradicted each other on that, right? John Dowd said Mueller needs to go, and then the next day Ty Cobb, I think, said, no, there's absolutely no – he's not firing. He's not being fired. So who knows what's happening? Quick question, Haroon, before you leave, and we'll absolutely have you back. We'd love to have you back. Your favorite Secretary of State?
Oh, man, that's a good one. Favorite Secretary of State, I would say, would be – you know, it's interesting. I actually would say Colin Powell, only because I think that some of the stuff that he did was not in terms of the outward foreign policy side stuff, but he made a lot of reforms at state that – we are benefiting today, and he really won over staff. People still talk about he promoted a lot of key folks that are ambassadors today. I mean, he did a lot of things that are not sexy, that were not well known, but he put the time in to really win over people. So I give him props, not in terms of the foreign policy stuff that he did, but because the way he built state, other secretaries have benefited from. So Colin Powell gets my vote today.
Thanks so much. All right, I'm going to encourage our readers once again to check out your books, Digital World War and Countering Hate. And Haroon, how can they find you online?
They can do it on Amazon. They can. We have this website called counteringhate.com.
Are you on social media?
I'm on social media at Haroon Ulla is my handle on Twitter and on a bunch of platforms. But love to be in touch. And I'm just so thrilled that you guys had me. I mean, this is so exciting. And I hope I can come back on.
For sure. Thank you so much.
Maybe you can join us in a live show one day.
Yeah, once Pompeo gets fired, you can come back to brief us on it.
Once Pompeo gets fired, we'll have you back. You guys have a great week, and we'll be back in 7 days with another show for you guys. Thanks so much. A big thanks to all our listeners for tuning in to the 45th podcast week after week. And if you'd like to give us further support, you can do that by becoming a patron at patreon.com/45thpod. By doing so, you can become a supporter and patron for as little as $5 a month. And to do so, again, go to patreon.com/45thpod. A shout out and thank you to our sponsors. They make this program possible. And I urge our listeners to please check out our sponsors and use their products. And thank you to them for helping us produce week after week. Thank you to our audio producer, Hannah McCarthy, our executive producer, Meethal Thelhan. We have been produced by Long Arc Digital Media, and you can find us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. Our handle is at 45th Pod. Our website is www.45thpod.com. And guess what? You can even leave us a voice message. Call us at 202-670-8345, and you never know, we might just play your message on the air. Thanks again for tuning in. See you next week.